Blog Talk Radio.
Arizona Boomer Radio brings you Straight Down the Middle, Arizona's only internet golf show. Straight Down the Middle is produced by the Boomer and the Baby Incorporated in partnership with GolfMix.com. GolfMix is your place to read course reviews written by recreational golfers just like you. Learn about the course you're going to play. Check out GolfMix before your next round. Now it's time to hit it straight down the middle.
Four!
Straight down the middle. It went straight down the middle. Then it started to hook just a wee bit. And that's when McCaddy lost sight of it. That little white pellet has never been found to this day. But it went straight down the middle, like they say. Whack down the fairway. It went smack down the fairway. Then it started to slice just a smidge off line. It headed for two, but it bounced off nine. My caddy says, long as you're still in the state, you're okay. Here's it went straight down the middle, fine away.
Yes, and welcome to Straight Down the Middle. Straight Down the Middle is the Internet Golf Show brought to you by and produced by Peterson Brown Incorporated, Boomer and the Babe Incorporated. And we're waiting for Mr. John Bloom to get to us from the Masters. This is our live from the Masters show. We're very, very, very pleased that John's going to be able to come in from there with his other duties as working in the truck for CBS Sports. Making sure all the shots are online, and he's covering the press conferences and the media room. So he's trying to get all that stuff lined up, and we're waiting for him with either bated breath or breath that smells like bait, I don't know which, for John to come on board. In the meantime, I'm here with Mr. Kirk Getzinger. Kirk Getzinger is also with GolfMix. Kirk, how are you this evening?
I am great, Pete. It's a pleasure to be with you on this Masters Thursday. What a thrilling part of the golf year it is. For me, it's the pinnacle of the golf year, where we get to watch the annual contest and tournament in Augusta and watch the famous holes and the famous shots that have become just ingrained in all of our memories.
Well, it is, and I think it's also a situation where we have the big event here with the PGA, of course, up at TPC. We have all the hoopla and the rah-rah here in the Valley, and it's very well-known tournament for all the rowdiness and tomfoolery and low scores and shooting the lights out and everything else. That's almost spring training, if you will, all heading up to the main events throughout the golf season, which starts, of course, with Augusta. I don't think there's anything in history, and I don't think there's anything that is thought of on the Pro Tour as being any more important than Augusta. I was listening to John do his tape of this precast with Aaron Overholser, and Aaron says, as far as he's concerned, it's not the U.S. Open, that it's Augusta, and that's where it all starts for him in his mind. So, and I think that's a pretty universal feeling, probably a great part due to the history, and great part due to the legend. It's certainly something that if he had the opportunity to be there as a player, I imagine you'd be shaking in your shoes.
Oh, I can only imagine, Pete, what it would be like to be standing there on the first tee, just trying to put the ball in the ground, let alone being able to pull the club back. I've had the good fortune to be there on three occasions as a patron myself for one of the practice days, and while you're there, your mind can't help but think, my goodness, if I could just stand back one time and pull it back here on the 12th tee and see if I could really get it up there by the green. It's one of those places, Pete, that my perception in terms of having been there, a lot of places we know in this world, there's a lot of hype, and they don't live up to it. For me, Augusta more than surpassed everything that I had ever heard of it, and always left me with the feeling that no matter how spectacular it is to watch the tournament on television, to look at the property on television, it never came close to capturing everything that's there when you see it on the ground in terms of the beauty, the demanding nature of the golf course, the undulations and the challenge that's posed by the approach shots into really tight corners of greens, and what the golfer faces hole by hole, especially on a course where, you know, many of them have played it 50, 100 or more times, and still there's subtleties and nuances that every year they're trying to come back and figure out. It is truly, truly an amazing place. And like you say, we could only always hope, all of us could only hope that that item on our bucket list got crossed off someday.
Well, that's very true. And part of the aura, as I think it might be sufficiently called, is the terminology, and you used the term in your latest series of statements, that you're not a gallery, you're a patron. And that just, that kind of sets it all up. I mean, that everybody that's there walking the grounds at that time of year and at that tournament are patrons, excuse me. You're not galleryites. And there,
nope.
it sets up something special, doesn't it?
It really does, Pete. And when you're there on the grounds, you know you are somewhere special. The people that work there and are taking care of the tournament are treating you as someone special, and it's an incredible situation. It really is. It's just nothing like I've ever felt in anywhere else I've ever been in life. And, you know, on Monday when I was, you know, sitting at home in the evening and kind of watching some of the video clips from the coverage there on Monday of the practice facilities, and you start to see some of the areas where, you know, where you've been before by the tee on 12 or by the tee on 16. And I honestly sit there and you start getting chills because you remember what it was like to be there and be part of it, and they're just memories that you carry with you for forever. And they remind me of the, you know, the things that I saw when I was there, and just, it's just 3 days of my life that I will absolutely never forget.
Well, when you were there and you saw it in person, you saw the course basically set up for the way the tournament was going to be played and the way it was manicured and so on and so forth. And then you see it on television. How much of that translates?
You know, Pete, when you first walk onto the grounds, one of the things you realize is there truly isn't a blade of grass out of place. It's just it's just amazing the quality of the preparation of the surfaces themselves. And then when you walk around and you start to look at, you know, you get some up-close looks at some of the greens, and you watch you look at the undulations, and you look at the shelves, and you look at the speed of the greens, and some of that gets captured on television. I mean, for instance, we can all remember seeing the green on 16 with the ball breaking down towards the left side there, headed towards the side of the green where the lake is. The ball rolling to the right of the green on 14 as it kind of slopes down. And so you see those things on television, but when you're standing there, and it's so much more dramatic in terms of what those slopes are, because they're just not things that we normally would see on the golf courses you and I might play on a regular basis. When you walk up the hill on 18, I mean, when you're walking it, and especially if you've been out there for a whole day and you're doing it at the end of the day, it feels like it's about a 45-degree incline. I mean, it is a really steep slope. So there's so many things that you just get to feel from being on the grounds there that television, you know, just due to whatever, you know, what the limitations are, you can't quite get a full 360-degree appreciation of the challenges and the shots that are demanded by the golf course. And when you see scores like we did today with some, you know, six and five and four unders, that is, you know, that's just tremendous golf. That really is, because every hole there presents a challenge in a different way. Every hole has some danger lurking, and if you, you know, fall asleep for a second. But by the same token, seeing these kind of scores, you know that great shots are rewarded there as well.
Well, great shots are rewarded, and I'm always amazed by the term, you have to miss it in the right place. I was watching some of the post-round interviews today, and one of the people that was explaining that was Fred Couples. And, of course, Fred Couples loves that place, and he plays it, generally speaking, quite well. Question is whether or not he's got the stamina and the back to hold up to go the distance. But his awe of that facility is recognizable in his speech. And when he says, well, you got to put it over here so that you can get to that pin. And Aaron was saying this, Aaron Oberholzer was saying the same thing talking with John. You have to know where to, if the pin is in this position A, then you have to put your drive in position A on the fairway so you can have access to that pin. If you miss the spot in the fairway, he says, then you're in trouble. And that's where you really start to run up your number, so to speak.
I can fully appreciate that. I remember one of the years I was there, we spent a lot of time on 13 near the landing area where the tee shots were. And just to see the differences in what your options are in terms of coming into that green, if you get that perfect drive and you kind of turn the corner and you get it running down the slope there a little bit versus the shot kind of hanging up there on the right side, or worse even yet, if you pushed it off into the pine straw and the pine trees there on the right, makes a complete huge difference in terms of what you have to face in your second shot there. And it might be the difference of only a few yards on your drive. And I think that's part of the magic of the course, is that the precision that's required to create a great shot versus a shot that is, you know, in by the tour professional standards, maybe only average or less than that. That line is drawn really fine in a lot of places on the course. No question about that. One of the other places that I can think of, and it's not one that gets a lot of television coverage, is the third hole, and it's a short par four. And often they set the pin over on the left side where there's this little sliver of a green, a little small shelf that sits there. And the hole is only about, you know, 350 yards or so. And so you would think it's, well, this is going to be one that they're just going to sit there and then knock down birdies all day. And it's not, because the pin position is set up in a way that the ability to get the ball close to the hole is such a fine area. And if you don't, you're either left with a putt that is, you know, really difficult, or you can end up missing the green altogether on a shot where you would think normally this should be a slam dunk for those guys.
Well, imagine, if you will, being that 14-year-old kid that shot one over par. I mean, how good is that?
Pete, it is, to me, it is unbelievable. It is, and I can, you know, I can only hope that he makes the cut, and this could be one of the truly great stories, not only for this Masters tournament, but what it could do for golf in general in the long run if he's there to play 4 days this weekend. I mean, first of all, as you know, as Billy Payne was talking about it, and he was asked the same question in his press conference on Wednesday. Did you ever expect that an eighth grader would be playing here at Augusta, you know? And his answer was, you know, certainly not. I can't even imagine. In eighth grade, I was probably still trying to figure out how to ride my bicycle, let alone figuring out how to play Augusta National. And then he goes on to birdie the 18th hole, and he does it like he's been doing it all his life. I mean, it's unbelievable. But the thing that, you know, the combination of that and the announcement that was made this week about the drive, chip, and putt competition that's going to be started next year, which I think is one of the greatest things I've seen come out of the golf industry in many years, as an incentive and a driver and something for young people to strive for, be part of, and then you know, then be able to go to Augusta National and play the championship for this thing. I mean, can you imagine being a 10-year-old kid and getting the chance to go do a, you know, go do a drive, chip, and putt competition on the Sunday before the tournament at Augusta? I mean, you know, I can only think that in my day, if there had been something like that, I might have spent a lot more time practicing as a youngster. I can tell you, I would have been in line every year to be involved in that. And I really think that if that gets the kind of momentum that it can, and this young man, 14-year-old, having the success this year that I hope he does, it could be one of those moments, and I'm very hopeful that this is maybe one of those times where we're going to see a turnaround in terms of the golf participation by young people. You know, maybe this is one of these events and moments that just happen that can get more and more young people involved in the game and cultivate, you know, a real strong junior golf programs and interest in the game by teenagers and those younger than teenagers to be a part of golf. And I'm really hopeful that we can look back in 5 years and say, you know, what happened in 2013 at the Masters, plus the beginning of the drive, chip, and putt competition, started to turn things around in terms of youth participation in the game.
Exactly. I know I've gotten a lot of good response from the high school golf coaches in here in Arizona that that are saying that they're looking forward to what we're going to be doing for high school golf, and they want to participate on. And that's just based on one email that I sent out. So that's all good news, and anything like this might be able to help that. Let's get back to the pro side of the tournament. What do you think of the leaderboard? I have a few things that I might like to add, but what are your thoughts about the leaderboard, the way it finished up at the end of the first day?
Well, I think, Pete, it's an interesting mix at the top of the board. If I look at the first, you know, 12 players or so, you see some prior Master winners, Trevor Immelman, Fred Couples, Zach Johnson. You see some players who have been close to winning majors who haven't, Sergio Garcia, Dustin Johnson. And then you see a couple names in there like, you know, David Lennon and Mark Leishman, who it seems like every year, the first round of Augusta, there are a few names that pop up where it's just people you'd say, I don't see any way. Where did he come from to shoot this? But it just makes you realize how strong the field is when you see those people come up. I mean, I look at a couple of names. Two of the names that are very interesting to me at this point are two of the players at 4-under, and that's Ricky Fowler and Matt Kuchar. Ricky Fowler, I think, is one of those players that if the conditions are right and his game was on, and he almost could have been there today except for two double bogeys, he could go out and shoot a 63 or 64. He can just light it up and run off a string of birdies and produce an incredible round. Whether he's got one of those in his tank this week, we'll see. Matt Kuchar seems like to me that his game is at a point where he is so confident and everything is just, he's kind of running on all eight cylinders, but he just does it with an ease and an ability just to create consistent, strong golf shots that if he can carry that through four rounds, you know, I can see him being there at the end of the day as well.
What about this Leishman? What do you know about him? Anything?
I know he's an Australian. I don't know exactly the success he's had on tour. But again, he's a name that, you know, you expect to see a few names. You wouldn't call them unknowns, but they're names that have not been at the top of a Masters leaderboard or perhaps another leaderboard, in his past. But you never know. I mean,
well, that's true. You don't. You never know exactly what's going to happen because it's just so. Some of this stuff is just so implausible that it just you just cannot get it figured out, and you just have to sit back and go, "Wow, look at what's happening here." I'm amazed that Garcia is playing has played as well as he has today. He certainly has had his fair share of struggles, but lately he seems to have been playing better pretty much across the board in the last several tournaments that he's been in. But he always seems to be still he has the ability to blow up at any given time. And I'm wondering if he can pull it through. Based on what they were saying, and he was talking this afternoon also, it was a case where he was saying that this is the 20th anniversary of Seve's first win at the Masters. I think one of the people, commentators, was saying that. And it's the 20th anniversary of the first time Olafamo played at the Masters. Now, I thought I heard that right. But if that is the case, that's probably all the motivation this guy needs.
Well, I certainly think so. And, you know, the success that's preceded him by his countrymen at Augusta, and certainly Seve, when you think about, he was the first one that kind of that broke through kind of as a European and had, you know, not only regular success, you know, worldwide, but he had great success at Augusta, obviously. And so I would think Sergio certainly has to look back and say, I want to keep carrying that torch. And, you know, the one thing you wonder about in that situation is if the fire burns that strong where he says, okay, Seve did it, Jose Maria did it, now I want to do it, can you try too hard? And, you know, we know at Augusta you have to be doing well with the flat stick. And certainly there have been points in Sergio's career where, you know, the flat stick has been, you know, has been the problem for him. I don't think it's going to be a question of, Can he keep it in the right place off the tee? Is his iron game sharp? The make or break for him is going to be with the putter. And can he? And now, like you say, can he kind of control his emotions because he is a fiery sort, and he's been in situations before at the British Open where he's been close, and he's just and at the PGA and he's just been, you know, missed it by a shade. And, you know, sometimes it seemed like he's carried a little chip on his shoulder from that. Can you turn that around and turn it into positive energy? Or do you let it get you down and say, it happened to me before, and here it is happening to me again? And I think that's the challenge for him right now is to use those experiences, but flip it on its side and say, all right, this time I'm going to understand the things that happened then, and it's going to make me stronger, and it's going to make me better, and I'm going to create a result that I wasn't able to create in those situations.
I think that's points well made. I want to just take this moment here, Kirk, to let everybody know that they're listening to the Straight Down the Middle Golf Show. You can get to the Straight Down the Middle Golf Show at straightdownthemiddleshow.com. straightdownthemiddleshow.com, and you can listen to archives and also listen to the current shows as they're being streamed live on our website. We invite you to do that, straightdownthemiddleshow.com. In addition to that, we're waiting for Mr. John Bloom, who is over there working for CBS Sports, and he's in the truck, and I know that he had to change some of his scheduling around for his live screencast that he does from wherever he's located. And he had to change those things around because of a storm that's moving through. And so the inclement weather has maybe knocked out a bunch of stuff down there in at Augusta National. So we're going to sit here and we're going to Kirk Getzinger and I will sit and visit for a little while longer, and we'll see if John can get himself online. I know we billed this for everybody that John was going to be live from the Masters, and we have to apologize for the fact that he's not with us, but I'm sure it's through no fault of his. So we're just going to continue on here a little bit longer and see if John can shake himself loose from wherever or whatever he's involved in to to call in, as we had discussed. So that having been said, I was going to ask John this question. Kirk, and maybe you and I can kick it around. Here we are. We're at the end of the first round. Before we did the show, I talked to a few people, and I said, who would you take? Would you take Tiger against the field? And there were a variance in responses as far as what people would do. Tiger's now at 2 under. He's 4 shots off the lead. It is only the first round. Would you take Tiger against the field after the end of the first day?
Boy, Pete, that's a tight call. I'll tell you, I would not. And that's not because I don't think Tiger can win. I think he's clearly playing the best golf of anybody on tour right now. He's won all 3 stroke play tournaments that he's been in. And if he gets it going and puts a 65 or 66 up on the board, it could be lights out come Saturday. Who knows? But at this point, I think that there are so many other players. First of all, there are so many other players that are really good and could be the one to edge him out. Will he be in the top 10? I certainly expect so. But I think some of the intimidation factor he's had in the past is not there. I think all the other players that are looking at a tournament like the Masters they're there for a reason. They're there either because they want a tour event or they're in the top 50 in the world, and they know they can play. So being 4 shots back certainly doesn't mean that much after the first day. That's easily overcome. Could he go out and finish up 16 or 18 under? Absolutely. But I think you can look at, 20 or 30 names on that leaderboard who could be, mid-double digits come Sunday and be there to win it. Now, if he's tied for the lead going into the back nine on Sunday, I might have a different feeling about that question. but at this point, I'll still take the field, and we can talk at about 3 o'clock on Sunday, and I might have changed my mind by that point.
Yeah, I'm kind of in that same corner with you. I love to see him play well. I love to see him win. I love to see him coming down the stretch and spreading it out like he's going to the wire and just expanding his lead. But this tournament means so much, not only to him, but to all the participants, all the players. You stop and look at who's there with him at 2 under, and you go, wow, there's some people here that, I mean, if they're, Mickelson's only 1 over and 1 back of Tiger, and Phil had 1 over today, and what did he have, 2 bogeys, 3 bogeys along the way, and he's still at 1 over. So I mean, hey, that guy can play too. As that commercial used to say, these guys are good. And I think there are any number of players at this time. If Tiger had gone out today, and if Tiger had been at -6. Now it would have been. I'd have had more of a tendency to say, "Well, here he is. He's just going to keep this going now, and hopefully he doesn't blow up himself." But he didn't, and he's 2 over. But then again, the other side of the coin is, as they were saying on Golf Channel, 2 under is with playing steady golf is not bad for the first day, and he's still easily within reach of the leaders.
Yeah, I certainly agree, Pete, and I think, Tiger and Phil and the players who have played there, 10, 15, 20 years, they recognize better than most that this is a 72-hole golf tournament, and don't get too excited about one great round, and don't get too down about making a bogey or two, because this is a tournament where you are tested hole after hole, shot after shot, and you have opportunities to make birdies and shoot great scores, and you have opportunities to shoot yourself right out of the tournament in a 3 or 4 hole stretch. So keep that in perspective. Keep playing your game. They all, I'm sure, go in with very solid game plans about how they want to play specific holes and specific shots. keep playing your game. And look, winning a golf tournament always has a couple of breaks that come from the golf gods or wherever to help you win. And you mentioned Freddie Couples, and we all remember the shot on 12 that he hit that somehow stayed out of the water, and he won that year, and that was a big part of it. Even go back to last year with Bubba Watson's win and in the playoff. I mean, he will always be remembered, obviously, for the great shot that he hit out of the trees. But I could tell you, after being over on that part of the golf course, he's just as likely to be stone dead right behind a tree with that drive as he is with an opening that he could hit that miraculous 50-yard hook shot. So the winner's going to need a few breaks along the way. A ball that maybe hangs on the edge of the creek there on 15 and 15 or 13 that stays out instead of going in. Those are some of the things that can happen. And it's a long way to go. Tiger and Phil understand that, again, better than most of the players do in the field. And they realize you just have to keep moving yourself up and then get yourself in position on Sunday where you can go to those holes there where you've had success in the past. You know how to create that success and then make it happen. And that's one of the things that gets me so fired up about the Masters is you think about when the players have won, they've gone out and won the tournament. Charles Schwartzel goes out, makes four birdies in a row to end. We can remember the birdie putts that, Mark O'Meara or Phil have made on the last hole. It's usually a shot or a series of shots that create birdies that create the victory. And to me, this is why, one of the many reasons why the Masters is such a great tournament. A lot of times we'll watch the U.S. Open, and you kind of feel like it's the last man standing won. Everybody just kept taking punch after punch, body blow after body blow, and finally the last man standing is a two or three over par, and they've survived, and they've gotten through. At Augusta, it always seems like that player did something to go out and win the golf tournament. Maybe it's a phenomenal round on Saturday, and he stretched himself a big lead and he carried it through. More often than not, it's something great that happens on the weekend. I mean, we all remember what Jack did in 86 in the back nine. It feels like somebody is going to win the tournament. And to me, that is what makes this tournament so exciting and such a thrill to watch, and why you have to be there for the last nine holes to see it, because that's what's going to happen. Somebody is going to distinguish themselves and create something at the end of that tournament. But obviously, they have to play great golf to get there, but then something's going to happen at the end that's going to be that trigger point for victory.
Well, we're going to find out what John Bloom has to say about it, because John's with us now. John, glad you could make it. Welcome to the show.
Oh, I'm glad to be here, fellas. How are you? Sorry it took me a couple minutes to finish my duties out here, but I love the passion coming from KG right now. I could just hear it because I know he's been here and walked the hallowed grounds, and he has as much of a passion for this place as anybody I know. So I'm glad that that's coming through from Kirk. What a day. What a day for round one here at the Masters. I mean, if you thought there were a ton of storylines coming into the week, I think they were actually multiplied after day one, and that's hard to believe. I mean, I just got done talking with Aaron Oberholzer, who's, of course, a partner of ours with Golf Mix, and this week he's in Orlando on the Golf Channel all week. You get to see him before the coverage starts, and he's been working around the clock as well. So we did a spreecast about an hour and a half ago, and talking about some of the things that were standout performances, if you will, today, and how can you discount what Fred Couples did at 53 years of age and with a bad back, going out shooting 68 like he was just having a stroll in the breeze, old Freddie, like we all remember, and that's an amazing story, but it gets almost pushed to the back because you've got a guy who, let me do the quick math, is actually less than a quarter of Freddie's age. Am I right on the numbers, KG?
You have nailed it on that, JB. And by the way,
yeah, less than a quarter of his age.
Yeah.
That's unbelievable. Going out and shooting 73 without sweating.
I mean, making a birdie putt on 18, like, oh, I've done this 1,000 times before. Thank you very much.
Yeah, and hitting a five wood.
He probably has done it 1,000 times before, but just never on that course, and he didn't realize where he was.
Well, here's the thing. You know what? I've done a lot of thinking about this guy, and it is amazing. But after talking with Aaron, too, I thought of it this way. Tianlong Guan is the name of the 14-year-old boy that we're talking about, and that's what he is. He's a boy. I mean, 14. Let's all remember what we were doing. And I said something earlier today. Show me a 14-year-old that could shoot 73 at the Masters on a video game right now, and I'd be impressed. Let alone go out and do it in the actual Masters. It's mind-blowing. But here's the way I think the brain works. He went out there 2.5 weeks ago, I believe. He's played a dozen rounds before the tournament started. And when you're young and you have this developing brain and you're learning by rote and you're memorizing things and you're learning numbers like I know Kirk was and probably completely into even at the age of 14, and I was too back then, he put it together. He kind of, you know, put this whole game plan together over the course of the last 2.5 weeks. And now the execution is the mind-blowing part. But I'm not trying to discount anything that Guan is going to accomplish this weekend. I actually will be surprised if he doesn't make the cut. Is that a ridiculous statement to make here after day one? But I will. I'll be surprised if he does not make the cut, because at this point, I think he's got that brain conditioned to make it happen.
Well, let me ask you this, John. Do you think he's won over? Where do you think the cut might fall based on what you've seen? Now, sure, if the course is wet, the greens are holding better, and I know Aaron was talking about them sucking the stuff, the wetness, the moisture out of the greens. But what do you think the cut line could conceivably be based on? Did you discuss that with Aaron at all?
We didn't get to that, but I do, you know, in thinking about it, it's always tough to say, Pete, too. Plus, when we know we're supposed to get, I don't know what it's going to be, hail, firestorm, all kinds of things that are being predicted for tonight overnight. I just hope I sleep through it, wake up, go over down the street on Washington Road, and we get golf started as usual at 8 o'clock. That's what I'm hoping. But, you know, the weather's supposed to come in overnight. You don't know how that's going to really affect the course. Sure, you could predict that they'll use the sub-air system so the greens could stay as perfect as they were before the rain started falling. I would not question that ability at all from the guys at the Masters and Augusta National. The other option is that the fairways get really sloppy. And then that stinks for the spectators. Kirk, I think you've been there when it's rained a lot. They put all that manure down. I mean, you're talking about going to the most beautiful place on the planet, practically, and then you got to smell manure the whole time. That was definitely one of the biggest buzzkills for me when I first figured out that they did that.
Yeah, you go to the Masters, you pay $1 million to get there, you pay $1 million to get on the grounds, pay $1 million for your hotel room, and then you go walk in the cow field.
You know, I think tomorrow it is going to be very interesting. And again, like you mentioned, the weather is going to be a huge determinant. First of all, we've got the good news is, John, is that you're still about 5 hours away from the storms hitting. And the bad news is the storms are about 5 hours away from hitting. And it's been just looking at the Doppler radar before I came on here with Pete. It's going to storm there tonight, and it's going to storm hard. And it looks like I was there for the practice round in 2011, and we had a storm come through that night at virtually almost the same time and did the same thing, and it really ripped through the course, did a lot of damage, actually even took down a tree on Magnolia Lane. That's how strong it was when it came through.
Yeah.
So the combination of the timing plus the cleanup that'll have to happen, I'm sure, as a result of that, if it does come through as strong as it looks like, I think the 8 o'clock start is probably in question tomorrow. But when you get back to the question of the cut, I mean, the average, you know, you know me, John, my fascination with statistics, and I was thinking about the same thing today. Where can we expect the cut to fall? And if you go back the last 10 years or so, the average cut is around 4 over. Actually, the lowest cut ever that there's been at Augusta is 1 over, and it's happened a couple times in the last 10 years. Now, tomorrow, if the wind is up after the storm, as they're suggesting 15 or 20 mile an hour winds, well, we know what that's going to do to that golf course. The scores are going to go up. So he is going out in the early groups. He is in the seventh. Mr. Guan is in the seventh group tomorrow. So I'm not sure where that's going to leave the course and the wind in terms of that. But if he can go out there and get a little momentum going and shoot some par golf on the front nine, we're going to see him for the weekend. And that would be just a phenomenal thing, a phenomenal story for the game, and something that, you know, we can all say we watch. And, you know, watching a 14-year-old at Augusta, I don't see that one happening very soon in my lifetime again, that's for sure.
It is it's a wild deal, and you're right. He has to work to make this cut, regardless. And I think that you know, making the comment I did, I'll be guilty of being carried away by the story, but I also just believe in the game because I'm watching him hit these hybrids and these five woods, pure. I mean, he's able to basically pick a spot and land it there with a five wood, and he's done it 3 days in a row that I've seen on the 18th hole alone. And it's just amazing to see, you know, that pinpoint control with that kind of a club. It's going to get tougher, though, if those fairways get wet. And that changes the game because he is hitting such a longer club than the other guys. He's at a huge disadvantage from that standpoint. We already know he's at a disadvantage from, you know, inexperience and youth standpoint, although you could argue that based on what I said before about conditioning himself over these last couple of weeks. But... it's impressive nonetheless. I want to hear from you guys, too. I mean, what else really stood out? Having a chance to watch the broadcast, as you hopefully did have the chance to do today, to you guys.
Well, John, what I was mentioning with Kirk before you managed to get on was I'm surprised that Garcia is there. Not that he's not, you know, at the event, but I mean that he's leading it. I'm surprised.
I mean,
I like Sergio Garcia. I think he's a fine golfer, but he has a propensity to have a bad hole or four. And I'm surprised that he held it together and he comes in at minus six. I think that's great.
Yeah, he's played well here before, but last year, you know, he had a bitter taste in his mouth. So I think that there's a lot of people that are surprised that he's back here. And I wonder if part of it is that he kind of wrote it off as, I just don't think this place is for me. And so maybe he didn't put as much pressure on himself as he has in the past. And he came out and shot 66 today. I mean, that it could be as simple as that because, frankly, I do think he has the game suited for this golf course, and he's showed that in the past. I mean, he has been competitive here and contended. So I'd like to see him contend. I like Sergio, and I like his game, and I think and sometimes he gets a bad rap. He's got certainly some temper and some fire, but those of us who share those characteristics like to call it passion.
That's true. John, I also mentioned Kirk and I were also talking about Tiger. You can't mention the Masters and not talk about Tiger. And we were discussing whether or not we would still take, if we ever were going to take, Tiger against the field the way it's shaped out after the end of the first round. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I said I would not take Tiger against the field. However, I picked Tiger to win. So there's your conflict that I'm in the middle of. But, you know, I am still thinking he's in a great position to win, and so I'm not going to change my pick. However, you know, just as I would not change taking him over the field, I just think that, you know, from a standpoint of odds and even a standpoint of looking at recent history, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense right now. He has to prove that. And I'm interested to hear or see how he follows this one up because I do think he's in good position. I think playing in the afternoon tomorrow may actually be an advantage, as Kirk was trying to or kind of alluding to, talking about the morning versus the afternoon. But we won't know. And I just think the advantage is for Tiger to have basically the opportunity to oversee what happens in the morning. And any kind of extra information that guy gets, I think ends up being in his favor. So he'll be able to take that in and have, you know, realistic expectations for what he wants to accomplish tomorrow afternoon. And hopefully he tees off right when he's supposed to. I believe it's right around 1:40 our time here in Augusta and 10:40 a.m. for those of you in the desert. And, you know, it was an interesting thing today. I don't know if you guys heard this, but you probably did if you got a chance to listen in with Aaron and me on the Spreecast. But the conversation with Jack Nicklaus, which I've now seen written up by a couple of people that I don't even think were in the scrum when he was having that conversation about Tiger Woods.
You mentioned that in email. I was just going to ask you that question. Please elaborate on that.
Well, yeah, I want to get your thoughts on this because I can certainly talk, you know, about my feelings about Tiger Woods, but I think I've had the conversation before with you guys. To hear Jack Nicklaus in the way he described it, and it's not just the words, which you can read, written up by the Associated Press. I think ESPN had an article out on it, a bunch of different sources online. You'll find it, Tiger Woods talking about his relationship, or Jack Nicklaus talking about his relationship with Tiger Woods, and the fact that they've never had a conversation longer than 1 or 2 minutes, that Tiger has never asked him anything about golf, anything about his majors, anything about what he thinks about Augusta, or anything related to the sport, basically. And this is through the times that they've played together, times where Jack has been the president, the captain of the President's Cup team, times of interaction, but no substance of conversation. And there are two things that really struck me on this. One, the emotion that was coming out of a man that, frankly, I've heard a lot from, especially the last couple of years, more so than in his playing days, and never saw a huge amount of emotion, not nearly as much as you see from, say, Arnie or several other players. But I could kind of see it, like peeling back an onion there with Jack Nicklaus. And the other one was reinforcing the theory I have about Tiger Woods, which is a theory that's shared by many, that he has been programmed to be what he is since he was such a young child. And you know, he's hunting. That's what he's doing. He was programmed to be the hunter. He did it to himself, putting Jack's record up on his wall and making that a target. So maybe he looks at Jack as the hunted, and for that reason doesn't wish to engage, you know, on a deep level at all. And I hope that at some point in time that changes. I really do, because I think if it does, I'll have more respect for Tiger Woods as a human being. And he has a ways to go to earn my respect from that standpoint, and that started as a 16-year-old boy. So I don't know if that will necessarily happen, but I do want to know what you guys think about that conversation, about just does it make you feel any different about Tiger Woods than before you heard about it?
No, it doesn't, and I'll tell you why, because I think the person that was making those comments was much the same when he was younger. And I don't think that Jack Nicklaus was particularly enamored with Arnold Palmer. And I think there's a certain parallel there. As Jack has gotten older, he has become a little less rigid in his thought process. He thinks that he may be in some way the senior member, and maybe he should be people can come to him. But nobody was able to come to Jack and talk to him before any more than they were able to talk to Tiger, if I remember correctly. So I think there's an element of history repeating itself, at least to some degree. That's kind of my take on it, because I've seen Jack operate on one of his courses in California when I was out there covering the opening of the course. And believe me, until he was ready to turn it on and tell everybody how great his course was and the wonderful things he was doing, he was nowhere to be seen. Even when a man with two prosthetic legs hit one up close to the pin, he didn't even turn around to bat an eye. He just walked away because he didn't want to engage. And that's the way Tiger seems to be. And I think it's a case of it repeating itself.
Well, I think, you know, first of all, John, in hearing and reading what Jack had to say today, it perhaps doesn't surprise me that much about Tiger, because he is so focused on beating Jack's record in the majors. And he just, you know, that is such a strong direction of his. And he just, that's so much of where he's in. But I take it one step even further back about Jack's being surprised that Tiger wouldn't engage more with him. And I'll go back to his relationship with Bobby Jones. And when Jack was a young man, you know, growing up and starting to be a dominant force in amateur golf, you know, it was Bobby Jones' major record that was out there. And Bobby Jones did engage with Jack as a young man. And they did develop a friendship as Jack became a professional. And obviously, by that point in the 1960s, Bobby Jones was in, you know, had considerable health problems because of the paralysis. And so, but their contact did deepen and it did increase. And so perhaps some of the, if you will, the frustration maybe that you heard from Jack a little bit today is that when he was a young man growing up and beginning to make his mark in the golf world, he was getting, you know, some kind of positive reaction and association with the man whose record he was going after. And if Bobby Jones' record was just as much of a focus to Jack as Jack's record is to Tiger. And maybe Jack feels a little frustrated in that, okay, if this is the guy who is going to take down my record someday, I'd like to have a little, you know, I'd like to have a little more of a connection with him than I do. And, you know, that those feelings would come out, and that the emotion, like you described, John, is there, is very interesting from my standpoint as someone who has, you know, kind of watched Jack's career all the way along. And I think it was very insightful comments that he shared.
Yeah, it was. And you know what? I'll elaborate on some of them that you may or may not have seen, but he did discuss the Bobby Jones record and how it did mean that much. And he, you know, even got upset when he was explaining how they removed the amateur majors from the major record. You know, his 18, that doesn't include his national amateur championship. So he got upset because he lost two, he said, in the record. So his record, I guess, it would have been 20. You could tell that it meant something to him. There's no question, and it should. You know, I mean, that's an impressive accomplishment. It is the most impressive accomplishment in a lot of people's eyes with regards to this sport. So it's understandable that it has that meaning. It was fascinating to see that come out. I mean, I just happened to be, you know, you talk about wanting to be a fly on the wall. That's what I was. I was under the oak tree. I was there to meet and have a couple conversations. Saw the CBS guys and that, and then saw Jack just wandering out and talking to, you know, a handful of reporters. So I basically just walked up and, you know, I've been in these scrums a lot as a reporter. But in this role that I have this week, I'm not necessarily playing that role. Now I feel like I am because we're having the conversations about this, you know, both on Golf Mix here on Straight Down the Middle, as well as on ArizonaSports.com. So it's being worthwhile to get this out. And the other thing that I wanted to talk about, which should be of interest to people listening in Arizona for sure, is the credit that he gave to all the people that are involved with the Waste Management Phoenix Open, in a conversation we were having about his frustration with his tournament in Columbus, Ohio, a great tournament called the Memorial, held at his golf course in Muirfield. And, you know, he's very frustrated that the tournament is doing so many things on such a high level, except for raising funds for charity. Now, that's not to sneeze at. I'm sure they're still in the seven figures, but he's looking at some of these other tournaments, and he recognized the Byron Nelson in Dallas, in the Dallas area. He recognized last week what they did at San Antonio, and then I brought up to him about the Phoenix Open, and he did have high praise for what the Thunderbirds do and is amazed at what they were able to get from a gate standpoint. He said, did they really get over 100,000? I said, yeah. I mean, they got over 500,000 for the week again. And you could see just the admiration for that. But it's something for me to see him, you know, have the passion that he does for the things he's involved in. And I think, you know, the reason why he's probably not playing competitive golf at all is because he has these other venues now where he is able to compete, and one of those venues is growing the game of golf, and I had a chance to talk to him a little bit about that too, and that was a great conversation. Even got into what we're doing with Golf Mix, and that was a thrill to be able to, you know, have that conversation with Golden Bear. It was not something I expected to happen on the first round of the Masters, so glad I was able to share that here too, and hope that, you know, it was and it's something worth sharing for those who are listening.
Well, I thank you for it, John. That's all great information and a lot of fun to hear you talk about it. I think that Nicholas's place, as many others, is certainly assured in the annals of golf, including what he does and the way he's done it. And there is yet to be many chapters written for Mr. Woods. Hello?
Was that for me? Sorry about that.
I threw it out there as I sometimes do, you know.
I'll respond to it. Here's the deal, and I was taking a quick bite of my dinner here, so that's why I was quiet. You know, Tiger, as much as I get down on him about his character and the person that he is, not the golfer, because he's a phenomenal golfer, he's in great position, I picked him to win it, and I still think he will. And if he does win this week, then I will be convinced that he will break Jack's record, which many still are, and some question. I am in the middle. I'm reserving judgment because why do I need to think it? Frankly, nobody cares what I think anyway, so I'm going to just hold off and see what happens. But I think that there's a good chance he can. And what I will do to defend him in some small fashion, there would be people that would absolutely lose their minds if they heard me defending Tiger Woods right now. But the reason I will is that he's 37 years old. That means that, as you said, Pete, there's a lot of chapters yet to be written. And maybe he will change. Maybe. I mean, it's going to take something pretty massive to change him. But that massive thing could be retiring from the game of golf. And when that happens, who knows what it's going to be. I used to think it would be 40. I used to think he'd be done playing golf by 40. I was very convinced of that because of, you know, what you see from child prodigies. When people, human beings, are conditioned to do something at such a young age and do it for a long, long period of time, it's very, very hard to see them do it, you know, for the length of their lives, you know, and do it happily. And I don't know if he will still. So, you know, he may decide that there are other parts of life that he wants to focus on. And when he does that, you know, then maybe he'll turn around as far as the character is concerned and then maybe, you know, he'll earn some of that respect that I was talking about earlier.
Well, you know, think about it, John. And going back to Jack for a second, and this happens with a lot of athletes, the most memorable points of their career may come right at the beginning and right at the end. And I think with Jack, you could certainly say that was the case. Coming right out onto the scene, winning the U.S. Open as he did at Oakmont, defeating the golf hero of the day, Arnold Palmer, in his backyard, and just, you know, coming out as the kid from Columbus, and all of a sudden he came out as the bad guy, not a great new golfer on the tour because he beat Arnie. And then go to the end of his career where he has, you know, arguably, you know, the most famous Masters victory ever in 1986 at 46 years old. So he bookends his career with two of the most memorable events in golf. Now, you can look at Tiger and say the same thing. He comes out in 1997, laps the field at Augusta in his first event, his first Masters as a professional. Maybe there's something at the back end, like you say, that obviously we haven't seen yet, but maybe one of those moments that will be a defining or the defining event in his career.
John,
a back end moment. Fred Couples at 53 is one thing, and let's see if he can stay in it for the rest of the weekend. Do you think Phil Mickelson is at a back end, you know, right now where this could be one of his last chances for one of those moments? I mean, there are several people I've talked to this week out here who I trust in their opinions in golf, and it seems to be a prevalent opinion right now that this is kind of that back end for Lefty, and this could be one of those last opportunities for him.
I don't think so, John, and that's not just because I picked Phil to win this week. I think, at least it's with regards to Augusta, my feeling has always been that his fire burned stronger for that place than anywhere else. And I think he's got at least one more and maybe more than that Masters in his future. And he would be one of those kind of guys that I could say, hey, maybe he'll be the one to beat Jack's record and win it when he's past 46, because he clearly still has the game. I don't think there's a real question about that. I mean, has he been a little up and down this year? Very certain, no question. But I think we've seen a lot of times in Phil's career where he goes through these stretches where one week he's the Phil Mickelson at the Phoenix Open shooting 28 under, and then the next week he's, you know, missing the cut and on the plane on Friday afternoon. It just seems like it's two different people. But I still see it there for him, and I would guess he has a very strong desire to get at least one more at Augusta and get himself up to number four and then say, you know, there's only four guys that, you know, have done this. It's me and Tiger and Jack and Artie. And I think that is a very burning desire for him right now.
I would agree with that, and I still think he's got the game, but I think he's got the game from time to time. I don't think he has the game on a consistent basis, and I think, as I think he also does, is he has to pick. He picks and chooses. He picks his fight, so to speak. Augusta is certainly one of them. That's the place that he wants to come, and for many of the reasons that you just enumerated. And I think he's always going to have his favorite places to play where he has a good chance of winning, just like Tiger has a great record at several golf courses, and that's where the multitude of his victories have been. And it's different courses for different horses. And Phil likes Augusta. He'll be able to play there until the cows come home, as long as he wants to, as long as he's healthy, and I think he'll keep trying. If nothing else, if he plays one tournament a year, I think he'll play Augusta, and that's the way I think. I think he's got plenty of game left, but he doesn't have plenty of game left on a consistent basis.
Yeah, that's it. Consistency is huge. I think we all know that. Hey, I saw a really funny comment. And Kirk and I had a chance earlier in the week to talk for just a few minutes about the announcement that the folks here at Augusta National made, Billy Payne and company, Mr. Chairman, as he's referred to here on the grounds, about the partnership with the PGA of America and the USGA and the Dry Putting Chip Championship. This is pretty cool, and I'm excited about it. And I don't know if you guys touched on it in the couple minutes before I jumped on, but I know Kirk has a feeling about it as well. But the reason I thought of this was I saw a comment on Twitter about the contest and how Tin Long Guan is definitely setting up for a great chance to participate in that contest, because he'll be 15, he'll qualify. And the way he's putting and chipping, I think the driving, you know, he's going to have some competition, but the putting and chipping, he's looking pretty good to be back there on the Sunday before the Masters next year to compete in that. Anyway, the long and the short of it is, for those who haven't heard of it, and I think the website is driveputtchip.com potentially, or driveputtchipchampionship.com. I'll check that while we're on. And it's a fantastic idea. I mean, frankly, it's one of those ideas I wish I came up with. I really do, because it does have the potential to do what we're all trying to do, what you're trying to do, Pete, with Straight Down the Middle, what we're doing with Golf Mix, trying to grow the game, trying to open the doors to golf as opposed to close them. And this is going to do that to the place that all of us salivate about walking on, you know, let alone just having a club in our hands, but just walking on the grounds at Augusta National. And now the best drivers, chippers and putters from around the country, ages 7 to 15, which is just upsetting me to no end, because my daughter's 6, and I think she could definitely have a chance in her division. So maybe next year. We'll get her ready for next year. But the best ones will qualify to go to Augusta National on the Sunday before the Masters next year and compete. They'll do the driving and the chipping on the practice range, and they'll do the putting on the 18th green, where the big boys play at the Masters. How good is that?
Well, you know what's I think really, really neat about that is we were talking about the allure of the tournament, the allure of Augusta National, and to the point that when Kirk was having some nice things to say about it and about his visits there, that the term patron was used, because you're not a galleryite, you're a patron. Almost the American royalty when it comes to location for golf, just like the Opens are, the Open Championships are in Great Britain. So it has this perception, and one of the perceptions it also has is that only certain people get to play that golf course, and if you don't qualify, you don't get to play. Now, that's a bit sarcastic on my part, and it's intended to be so, because I like the fact that these young kids are going to be able to play out there, and it should mean something to them, and it will mean something to them, but they're going to be able to come there with a completely youthful approach and have a great time, and I think that's wonderful.
Yeah, John, it's a great insight that I guess I hadn't thought of, that if Tin Yuan Guan doesn't qualify by winning the Asian Amateur again next year, like you said, he can come back in the 15-year-old division and win. So, but I think, Pete and I touched on this a little bit before you came on, this is a tremendous thing. And I think I'd like to even take it one step further. And I think it's a call out to the golf community, the golf industry, and the golf club owners to do something to foster junior golf at your club. And I think it's everything. I mean, if Augusta National can get behind something like this and bring youngsters to Augusta National on the Sunday before the tournament, what are you doing at your local club to foster a junior golf program or something to get more kids interested in the game? I mean, throw open some tee times at 4:30 in the afternoon where kids can come out and play for a dollar or something like that to get kids onto the golf course and playing. I really think that this could be one of those moments and pieces of ammunition, if you will, to get kids into the game who are thinking about it, or get kids more active in the game who are maybe just a little bit involved with it. And so it goes beyond not only this contest, which is unbelievable, and it is one of the best things that I've seen come out of golf in many years, but it has the potential to take it so much further. And that's what I love about it. And I only hope it becomes 10 times the success that I already foresee it becoming.
Well, and here's why I think it will be so successful, Kirk, and I echo your comments, both of you, on this. I just see it having the golden ticket effect. I'll remember Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. I feel like getting an opportunity to go to Augusta for kids who may have watched the Masters on TV with their folks, may have more likely played the Masters on a video game, and never considered that they would actually get to walk where the pros are actually playing the Masters at Augusta National. That's a big driver. But let's not forget the driver it is for the parents to have a chance to go to Augusta National. Are you kidding me? We always talk about the parents, who get their kids into baseball and then say it's a dad who ties his son's, right arm so he becomes a left-handed pitcher, and he has him working in the backyard, throwing it through the tire from the age of four, and, all those stories. So what's going to happen now with golf? Because there's going to be some crazy dads out there that are thinking, I can get my kid to be putting and chipping good at the age of seven, and we're going to be going to Augusta National. Are you kidding? What an opportunity. No, but I think it's going to be a massive success if they do it right. It all comes down to the execution of it for me, making sure that it's getting to the right places. Like you said, this isn't just great because Augusta National is doing it. This is great because it should have a great trickle-down effect to all the other private clubs, public courses, golf associations, everything out there to say, hey, if we were looking for a carrot, to draw people, we were just given one by the Green Jackets, the USGA, the PGA of America. They just basically handed us one. And in golf, it'd be very hard to find a bigger one than an opportunity to have your kid go play in this championship. So I am hopeful that it is executed properly. I'm very hopeful that we're going to be spending some time on Straight Down the Middle talking about some qualifiers in Arizona. I'm sure Tom Legering over at Sun City Country Club is going to have signs up by next week saying come qualify out here. And I hope that other people follow suit as well all over the valley and all over the state of Arizona and all over the country for that matter.
I think it's a great program, and I think it's wonderful that, and I hope that all these courses locally and across the country will participate to the fullest, and get these kids out there playing, because that's very, very important. We're kind of down to the short rows here. I set the program a little bit longer because I was afraid that this might happen. Not that I was fearful of it, but I'm glad it did, and I'm glad, John, that you managed to get yourself free from your duties so you could come in and talk to us and be involved in the program, because Kurt and I aren't there, and it's nice to have your perspectives. Let me ask you one last thing before we kind of wrap up, if I could, and then I'll ask, first of all, let me ask Kurt for his forecast for what he sees happening for the balance of the tournament.
Well, I see tomorrow as being a defining day. I see some separation happening tomorrow, and again, it's based on my thinking about what the weather might be. And when the winds go up, the scores go up at Augusta. And we know that Saturday is moving day, but I think tomorrow is going to be maybe a more important day in some senses. You might see some of these players that are at 3, 4, 5, even the leaders at 6 under, peel back if they run into difficult conditions. And that's where, at this point, I look to somebody like a Matt Kuchar, who, you know, seems so unflappable and so at ease in everything he's doing on the golf course these days. If he can maintain that for tomorrow, build another good round on top of this one, he's a name I would look at to be in very strong position for the weekend.
Well, I think he had a couple of bogeys and still finished at 4 under, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. And I like Kuchar a lot as well. And for the same reasons that Kirk just mentioned about the temperament and about getting around this golf course, I like Brant Snedeker and Justin Rose, who I liked going into the tournament, and they both will be playing. They're actually playing together. They'll be playing in the afternoon, I believe, tomorrow. And, you know, again, total crapshoot. I just hope that, come tomorrow night when we're back on Spreecasting, Aaron and I will be on again tomorrow somewhere, you know, around 8 o'clock Eastern or 5 o'clock Pacific. But I just hope I'm not talking about a devastating storm. You know, let's just, send positive vibes to Mother Nature that, go easy on us tonight. And we can get up and get golf in tomorrow as scheduled with no calamities, no any major problems here in the area. And I say that from experience because I have lived through a tornado here. I think it was 5 years ago, if I'm not mistaken. It was out near a place called Fort Gordon, and I was in a hotel, and I heard the sirens and got down on the ground. I didn't really know what to do. I'm a California boy. And then I went to Syracuse, and those places have their issues, earthquakes on the west and blizzards on the east. And then the time in Detroit, I was lucky enough to get out with any tornadoes or without any. But the one we had here was pretty darn scary and did some pretty big destruction. So I would prefer not to go through that again.
As long as the ground is shaking, you're happy. But don't let the winds blow.
Yeah, I can deal with the shaking. That's fine. I don't need that twisty thing taking me back to Tonto and the crew. Bert Tonto, what am I talking about? Not Tonto.
Toto.
Toto. Thank you.
Kansas,
can you tell it's been a long week already?
Yes.
Is it Thursday?
Yes, I can see. John, let me ask you one last question, and then we're going to wrap this up. Who is your darkest of dark horses at this point?
Xianlong Guan, does that count? No. my darkest of dark horses. I can't wait to see him play again, by the way. But let me throw you a name that I don't think a whole lot of people are talking about. And yet he seems to be sneaky. He seems to compete here, and that's KJ Choi. I don't know what it is. It seems like he just has turned his game off everywhere else. But when he comes back to Augusta, he finds it within him. I don't know. It's not a crazy dark horse, like somebody who nobody's ever heard of, and that's the thing. I don't think those people win here. Kirk would echo that. You know, when we went through figuring out the selection process for our Masters contest, you know, we were discussing all the factors and the odds, and you know, first-timers don't win here. So I'm not going to throw one of them out here, and I'm not going to pick an amateur either. I think, you know, the one who has the best chance to make the cut's the youngest, the 14-year-old. So, I think it's KJ Choi. Does that count?
Sure, why not? As good as any. I just wondered who was going to be. one thing I do want to cover before we go, John, tell us about when you're scheduling your spree cast. Tell us about the Masters contest that's up and the field is full now, I understand, for the Masters contest, but tell us about what people can expect there and what you're going to be doing for the rest of the event.
Sure. So spreecast-wise, we're scheduled for 8:30 Eastern, 5:30 Pacific. We had to change it today. Aaron got an early call for Golf Channel, so that was part of it. And then the other reason was that I had the impending weather, and they were telling us to get out of the compound. So that's why we moved it up. But regardless, whenever we do it, if you don't catch it live, you can go watch it right now. You can watch it anytime, just like you can listen back to these shows, too, that get archived. So you can go do that. And all of our coverage for the week is at golfmix.com/masters. It's as easy as that. It's just golfmix.com, no www, just golfmix.com/masters. And you're there, and you'll see, you know, I'm going to probably cut up some of the broadcast we did tonight on Spreecast. And I can put little clips in, and so you don't have to sit through 40 minutes. Maybe you'll watch a two-minute segment when we're talking about Tiger Woods and Jack Nicklaus or some of the other topics we discussed here on the show, and you'll get Aaron's take on it as well. So he's going to be on with me from Orlando. He's got his family in the hotel room as well, so that's another curve with trying to get a two-year-old and a four-year-old to bed simultaneously with doing a webcast. So we're doing it. We're patching it together. We're actually making it work so far, and we're excited to have the weekend to do it as well. And that'll be, again, 5:30 Pacific time, 8:30 Eastern time. That's the schedule for live. Love it when people come on live because you can interact with us by asking questions, by chatting in the chat room, and you can even go to spreecast.com to watch it, and then you can jump on your webcam. So if you have a webcam, you can come on and ask us a question face-to-face. We can have a little conversation that way. I'd love to make that happen this weekend. And then as far as the Masters contest is concerned, it's a full field. We have everybody assigned to their player, and it's going to be exciting to see who finishes in the top five to win all the gear that I bought at the pro shop at Augusta National. And then we're also giving away a prize to who finishes last this year, too. So somebody's going to be in the mix, even if their player is not faring so well on the hallowed grounds of Augusta National. So it's been a fun lead-up to this event. It's always an amazing whirlwind to work it, and this year I think with all the things that I've added on top of it, it's made it even more of a whirlwind, but I'm going to enjoy it while I'm here, and I have so far, and let's hope that the weather abides and that we're able to get everything in as scheduled.
Well, John, I've got an open spot on my logo ball rack. It's waiting for a Masters logo ball. Can you accommodate that for me?
Done.
Fantastic. Fantastic. I appreciate it. Any last words, Kirk?
Well, I just, you know, looking at what this weekend brings forward to us, it's always the unexpected. It's always something exciting. Like you said, there are dark horses that show up over the weekend that maybe they get there, maybe they don't. Maybe we see a first-time winner, or maybe we see someone who's been there before. But when you look at what this tournament is, when you look at the numbers of people that watch this tournament on television, you know, it is the one golf event every year that transcends golf. It goes beyond the avid golfers, like those of us here talking, and it captures so many other people because of what the event is. And whether you're an avid golfer or whether you're a casual sports fan, it is something special to watch, and I'm sure it won't disappoint again this year.
Absolutely. Well, I want to thank you both for being with me again tonight. John from Augusta National area, home of the Masters, obviously. It's been a great conversation. I'm glad you could make it in. And Kirk, as always, always insightful and always good things that you've added. I want to remind everybody you've been listening to Straight Down the Middle Golf, Straight Down the Middle Show at straightdownthemiddle.com. And also on Blog Talk Radio. We appreciate your listening. Next time you hear from us will be next Thursday when we do our regular show. In the meantime, you can follow us on Twitter, follow us on Facebook, and you can visit us at straightdownthemiddleshow.com. Thanks, everybody, for listening, and thanks again to John and Kirk. And we'll talk to you, John, when you get back, and Kirk, we'll probably be talking between now and then ourselves. Take care. Have a great evening, guys.
Happy All right, Masters, everybody.
All right. Good night, John. Be safe.
Listening to Straight Down the Middle on Arizona Boomer Radio. Arizona Boomer Radio is produced by the Boomer and the Babe Incorporated and can be heard Monday through Friday. You can sign up for their online magazine at boomerandthebabe.com. To reach the Boomer and the Babe, email host at boomerandthebabe.com or friend them on facebook.com/boomerandbabe. And on Blog Talk, you can friend them at blogtalkradio.com/boomerandbabe. Follow their tweets at twitter.com/boomerandbabe. Be sure to make the second half of your life the best half of your life. And remember, at 50, you're just getting started.